Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy. Well, David, I'd like to switch gears. You've mentioned a couple of times the department's unique environmental management cleanup efforts. And to that end, I'd like to get a sense of the progress to date. What are some of the challenges you face in this area, and how are you improving the performance in this area?
Well, let me start by trying to give a perspective on the size of the challenge. I don't know that this is the product of an official study, but in some conversations I've had with our environmental management program, when we talk and look at what remains, one estimate is that we have approximately $250 billion worth of cleanup work to do, and that it's going to take us 40 to 50 years to accomplish that work. And when you look at the size of that challenge, and if you go back and you look at the time frame of what it's going to take for us, for example, out in Hanford to build the facilities that we're currently building to get them to be operational, and once they're operational to begin to process the, you know, the 190-some enormous tanks of liquid waste that are there, we're going to be at this for quite some time. How do you do that better? I've also stated some of the challenges. You know, one of the challenges is that, you know, the U.S. government, we live in a budget-constrained world, and I don't think that's going to change in the foreseeable future. So we're trying to tackle a challenge that's a $250 billion challenge, and we're tackling it in $5 to $6 billion a year increments. And the other thing I've said is that we're also doing this in an environment where we have different states and different districts courts regulating what happens at each of our sites. One of the cumulative effects of that is that we don't really do what I would call a risk-based approach to tackling this challenge. We're not in a position where, as a department, we can go out and assess what we believe the greatest risk is from the standpoint of the waste that's there and the situation in which that waste is there, and assess what's the potential for that waste to leak into groundwater, to contaminate groundwater, to contaminate the environment, how safe and secure is the way in which it's being maintained now, et cetera, and basically do an assessment and really, if you will, tackle the greatest risk first, et cetera. We're not in a position to do that. But I would say when you said how do you go about doing it is we try and do that to the maximum extent that we can. And so within the confines of trying to put together a budget and dealing with our regulatory milestones and obligations, I'd say one of the ways that we face that challenge is to really try and work at it as much as we can through a risk-based process. And then I think another thing that we're really trying to do, and this is a priority and one of the advantages of having a scientist as the secretary, is that we're trying to develop new technologies to go out and manage these wastes. And down in Savannah River, the Savannah River National Laboratory is actually the laboratory of the Environmental Management Program. Although it does many, many different things, but one of its primary reasons for being set up was to develop new technologies that can come up with better ways to process this waste. And I'm not enough of a scientist. If I started to try and use the scientific terms to describe it, I would embarrass myself. But there's a number of areas where we've come up with new solvents, for example, where we can take out a contaminant out of a waste stream 4 to 5 times more efficiently than the previous one. And at the scale at which we're doing, that saves tens and eventually hundreds of millions of dollars as we process that. Or we've got new ways where we can put barriers between chromium that happens to be buried in some soils near rivers. We've got new ways to put barriers between that contaminant and the groundwater and sometimes the river that are much more efficient than what we've been using. And provide us an interim bridge to be able to get to the full cleanup of those contaminants. So I'd say that, and the Secretary has indicated, and it's one of his priorities as we move forward, to try and find funds so that we can, instead of just meeting the immediate milestones of what's required and the immediate day-to-day requirements of that program, that we can find ways to fund the development of these new technologies that usually are, I mean, groundbreaking is probably, you know, not meant to be a pun, but it really is. We and a couple other nations face these problems. And so, you know, in many cases, they're first-of-a-kind technologies, and it's research and work that's not being done anywhere else.
So, David, would you tell us more about your efforts at the Department of Energy to identify and dispose of excess of real property? What are you doing in the area of real property management?
One of our priorities, and I think just put a context to it, when I described the start of the department as having started in three remote places, Los Alamos, Hanford, Washington, and Oak Ridge, and we've expanded just by the nature of our mission, we've actually expanded to fairly remote places. I sometimes refer to the department as the Department of Inconvenient Places, and it's actually on purpose when you understand the mission, and particularly when you understand the secrecy with which the mission was started. And what's happened over time is that we have really substantial facilities, and communities have grown up around our facilities that are very much integrated with and dependent upon the Department of Energy. And as we've reduced the mission in terms of our commitment to nuclear weapons production and development is substantially down, and we're not running the facilities that we used to when we are downsizing. And so we are working as best we can to reduce our footprint. And as we reduce our footprint, we work with our communities to try and help them get the land and transfer land over to them where they see that they've got a need for it and it can be put to greater economic development and to help the community. We've just had two instances of it down in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. We transferred one parcel of land recently that I went down for and was pleased to be able to transfer back to the community. They've actually got an industrial park that's developed in Oak Ridge that's really quite productive. We're working with them because there's actually a really interesting new high-tech manufacturing facility that the Oak Ridge area is competing for, and the department is working with the Oak Ridge Community Development Organization to help them identify land and insofar as we can move forward with them to try and if in fact they prevail in terms of attracting that big investment. And part of why they actually want the investment, I think I may have said earlier that we consume 10% of the electric power produced in the United States. Our facilities are surrounded by a lot of the infrastructure that new plants and manufacturing facilities would like to have. And I think that makes that's part of why our facilities, if we, you know, when we're not using them, we can turn them over to communities that they become attractive. The city of Oak Ridge also is interested in building an airport. And they've talked to us, and we're talking with them as best we can about the potential to turn over some of that land for the community. But before we do that, we have to make sure, one, that all of the contamination on those facilities, on that land is cleaned, then that it's safe and that we can do so responsibly and also consistent with our obligations to all the other taxpayers of America, where that land has an economic value. If there's an economic value and we can transfer it there, or frankly, we can trade some of that land over in exchange for someone may want to use some of our land and as for economic development, and in exchange, they build a facility for us. So we're trying to use that land as a resource. We do that directly. We work with GSA to do that. But that's really, you know, one of the things that happens when the scale of the operations, by the nature of what it is smaller than it used to be.
Well, speaking about resources, and since you brought up GSA, I'd like to talk about your efforts to transform the department's contract management function. How are you using or expanding the use of the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative?
Well, we use the Federal Strategic Sourcing Initiative, but it actually is one of several different strategic sourcing initiatives that we have. We use that where we can. We have GSA scales and schedules, and those are available for all sorts of purchases, and we use them where we can. We also have, for example, within our science program, which is about a $4 to $5 billion program that also has 13 national laboratories, each of which is hooked up to an industrial or university partner. The Office of Science has its own strategic sourcing initiative. And there are other ones. NNSA, or National Nuclear Security Administration, has its own strategic sourcing. And as you might guess, they have some unique sourcing requirements. But the fact that they can do that amongst their various, across their complex, et cetera. One of the things we're trying to do, and we actually did this as part of the National Laboratory Operations Board, is one suggestion was, well, why don't we consolidate and use one of them? And what we realized is, hey, wait a minute. we've got four or five strategic sourcing consortia, if you will, that are working across our complex. What we want to do is broaden access to all of them. And if you will, in the interest of saving the taxpayers all that we can, don't just use the one strategic sourcing, whether it's GSA's strategic sourcing. We use three or four different networks. And I think that's kind of I think I wouldn't be surprised if that's typical across other agencies and departments, that GSA's is a very good one, but it's not the only one.
So what are you doing, David, to attract, retain, and train highly qualified skilled workforce and personnel?
Well, one is that we've just hired, brought aboard or about to bring aboard a new recruitment coordinator. And we're working as part of the President's Management Council has as its initiative. One of their initiatives is in the area of exactly that, to try and figure out, you know, for senior executives, for example, to figure out ways in which we can integrate better with the way hiring is done across the economy. And some of that is, can we move away from this ECQs, et cetera, and get to perhaps resume-based applications for positions? Can we reduce the hiring time? Can we be more efficient in the way in which we do that? Another aspect of that, actually, for the department is that we have just put in place a new legislated authority that we have for hiring 400, and I guess the description in legislation is exceptionally well-qualified individuals. We now have the new statutory authority to bring aboard scientists, engineers, project management experts, et cetera, for a period of up to 4 years in a non-competitive hiring circumstance. And we're just bringing that out. Our human capital office has put forward the processes and just established that. And a number of our programs are really excited about going out and recruiting, as I think President Kennedy said, the best and the brightest, and bringing them into government.
So I'd be remiss in not touching, under your portfolio is information technology. And I was wondering if there's anything in terms of goals or priorities you'd want to touch on in the area of IT.
Well, I think we talked a little bit about cyber. And overriding all of what we do in information technology is making sure that we have adequate cyber protections in place. And I think actually the department is one of the best in government in doing that, in part because that's one of the areas of expertise of our national laboratories. And we are developing cyber technologies that are used not just at DOE, but are being used across the private sector and across government. One of the underappreciated aspects of what the department has done is that, in fact, the department is really at the forefront of high-scale computing. Our exascale, a lot of the computers that we develop to do the simulations and a lot of the work that we do are lead the world in terms of that capacity. So, if you will, program computing that is as far ahead of as any in government, in many respects ahead of the private sector, and leads the private sector working with it. But we also have, if you will, you know, the desktop, the day-to-day. I will say that's one of the areas that's kind of tough to keep up with is that technology is always moving so quickly that you have to figure out how to keep up with it. And I think most experts will tell you that we are at the forefront. We're sort of at the leading edge right now of where so much more is going to go into the cloud and that sort of the whole technology is going to be changing. And one of our initiatives that we're underway right now is to figure out how to structure and shape the technologies and the capacities that the department has so that we are ready and in a position to take advantage of all of the advances that information technology is about to make.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Department of Energy? We will ask David Klaus, Deputy Undersecretary for Management and Performance within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.